Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint recap from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today, Matt is joined by Chuck Hill, retired Coast Guard officer, for a discussion on the design, use, and possibilities of naval corvettes. This is a reflection on the SIMSEC Corvettes Week in November of 2013. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. Immediately after, tell all of your friends. We think Sea Control is a fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is lying. They actually love the podcast and want you to listen to it. Now, sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Welcome, everyone. This week's topic is going to be corvettes. Now, some of you might remember back from November 26th to December 6th, we had this really successful week of articles on corvettes, and we haven't had the chance to visit them here on the podcast. So that was 12 posts by 9 different authors from 5 different countries, and it was some fantastic material, and it was all organized, arranged, and managed by our guest today, Chuck Hill. Welcome.
Hello, Matt.
Chuck, yeah. Now, if you could, Chuck, let's just go through as we do before every podcast. I could read a bio, and that'd be really easy, but it's better hearing it from the guest. So if you could give everyone an introduction, kind of you think are the important beats, and tell them who you are and where you're coming from.
Okay. I'm long retired. I'm an old guy now, but...
Young at heart.
Just had my 67th birthday, and... But I had 22 years in the Coast Guard, Academy graduate, 1969. But I always sort of had my one foot in the Coast Guard and one foot in the Navy, in a way. I was a Fleet Training Group liaison officer, went to Naval War College. I was the first Coast Guard officer to graduate from TAO school.
Well, that's cool.
I actually went through the Naval Control of Shipping course, too, while I was in San Diego. And I've always been interested in naval topics. High school, they called me the Admiral. So it's a long-term disease.
You started off so well, and then you went and called us a disease. That's awful. But Ed, I guess that just rubs off from being one of the coasties. And that gives you such a great insight and background. And I think it's important for folks to notice. I think some people might question, hey, if you've been in the business long enough, are people's thoughts and are their insights really valid, or do they bring a lot of baggage with them? And I think, Chuck, you're a great illustration that's a load of bullshit, is that you can be a spry young 67 years old and still have really fresh and interesting ideas when it comes to these concepts. And really, Corvette Week showed it, because you threw actually out at the first one at bat, you had an article discussing what corvettes really were. And I thought a really interesting point, and I think some of our other articles at other points in time have gotten into it, is what is a corvette? What are naming conventions? And your article on corvettes and kind of what they were started off with with this historical incident or instance where the British Navy takes corvettes, sloops, and frigates and all renames them cruisers. Now, today we look at cruisers and go, how could you confuse a frigate or a corvette with this monster that we have now that's a guided missile cruiser? And I think that's a great place to start off is – when we talk about these small boats and these sea fighters and these corvettes or whatever you want to call them, what are we talking about? What's the naming convention based on? And really, in the theories, what are we talking about? What are these ships? What are these ships' purpose?
As we mentioned, the name corvette sort of disappeared from usage. If you look back at the Alabama, the Confederate raiders during the Civil War, they were referred to as cruisers, even though they were officially sloops or something else. But basically, a cruiser was just a ship that didn't quite qualify for ship of the line, but was capable of independent steaming and doing missions basically all over the world. And when you had sailing vessels, there was essentially no limit on your endurance. And they were all capable of worldwide cruising, although some of them were better at functioning in the littoral. I saw some references in the Revolutionary War where they teamed up a 24-gun ship, which the French would call a corvette, with a 44-gun ship, which was not quite a ship of the line and bigger than a frigate, the typical frigate of the time. And the little ship would go in and work the littoral while the 44-gun covered them. So it occurred to me that that might actually be something to look at for us in the future.
Yeah, Sven Ortman was one of our writers, and he mentioned picket ships. So that's what you're talking about is almost a little different. Like the corvette was the operator, but it's the same thing. You have a big, powerful, expensive asset, and you have the small boat kind of working the high risk inshore stuff under the cover of the big guy.
Yeah, well, of course, being Coast Guard in the period that I was. The operations off of Vietnam, where the Coast Guard and Navy and the Vietnamese Navy were looking for gunrunners and that sort of thing in Operation Market Time, was very significant for me. I'm not sure, maybe lost, but the North Vietnamese were smuggling weapons down the coast of South Vietnam and running them inshore on steel-hull trawlers and junks and all sorts of vessels. And there was a pretty good-sized effort to shut them down. And I had air patrols offshore, and the rules of engagement were such that you couldn't actually take them out until they got inside 3 miles. So it was a sea control exercise, and it was actually pretty successful. We had 26 Coast Guard 82-footers, and we typically had five or so large cutters offshore. There were also Navy DERs and destroyers, that sort of thing. And when they weren't boarding vessels, they were also available for shore bombardment, that sort of thing. So they did a lot of that.
So for everyone's reference, just to kind of get a scope, you said a Coast Guard 82-footer. The U.S. Navy's smallest warship right now, so the ship, is 173 feet. So
right.
That's the size almost – that's roughly the size of a seagoing tug. So you're talking about something that is just under half that size, which is incredible. You actually – something that I was thinking about before we started the podcast is – you mentioned this word sea keeping in one of your articles. Is that just you talking about sea control, or are you thinking of a separate concept? Because I'd never heard of that word before. Is that more of a Coast Guard concept of law enforcement?
No, that's just a reference to the ability to stay at sea in bad weather.
Okay, that's all right. That makes sense then. All right, so we're talking about the gun running, and which is an odd combination. You're talking about a full blown war with the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese are shooting, and then you also have at the same time this law enforcement mission of a sort. It's kind of law enforcement being executed by the Coast Guard, which kind of leads us into the OPVs. And there's this interesting series of articles by you and Armando Heredia about sort of what are offshore patrol cutters or craft or vehicle, depending on who you talk to, and some suggestion that these are sort of I'll let you talk about it, because that was the whole part of the debate. Are these corvettes? Are these just non-wartime patrol vessels? Tell me a bit about what's an offshore patrol vehicle, and how does it come into this debate?
Okay. A lot of times corvettes will be used for constabulary stuff. You know, they do migrant interdiction, drug interdiction, fisheries patrols, that sort of thing. In the U.S., we have the Coast Guard that does that. But most countries Their Navy does it. So they have, it may be done by minesweepers, may be done by frigates, older frigates, that's in some cases. Sometimes you'll see corvettes, the Portuguese, the Italians, the Spanish, they've taken older corvettes and disarmed them so that they essentially only have one gun left, or maybe some machine guns. And they'll be used with a reduced crew to do offshore surveillance, presence, and law enforcement. And, of course, SAR. Right now, the Italians are having a big problem with migrant interdiction, and they're using some of their corvettes for that sort of thing as well. I wanted to go back for a minute to the question of what is a corvette and what is the size. Well, the terminology was reintroduced just before World War II for basically a patrol vessel that was intended for coastal operations, but they were long-ranged enough that they were used on convoys. The Royal Navy kept their destroyers for use against major units of the German Navy or the Italian Navy, and these corvettes and later frigates, which were slightly larger ships, handled most of the transatlantic convoys. They weren't very good ships. Corvettes are almost always going to be a compromise. They're compromised in their size and their seakeeping, their equipment, their crews. Basically, they're the low-cost spread in naval surface vessels. But in the U.S., we have the Coast Guard. And in a lot of navies, they, like the Coast Guard, build ships that are corvette-sized, even frigate-sized. Our latest Coast Guard cutter is 4,500 tons. It's bigger than the FFG class. In a lot of ways, it's more capable, much longer range. It's got excellent aviation facilities. It's got a range of over 12,000 miles. It's got a skiff that is an intelligence exploitation site, excellent communications, 3D radar, 57-millimeter gun. It's armed pretty much like a LCS. In some ways, you could almost say an LCS is a corvette. But the OPVs generally are optimized for constabulatory purposes. So they probably don't have a sonar, particularly. They usually have a medium-caliber gun, although some countries don't even have that. They might have a 20 or 30-millimeter. The British River class are about 1,800 tons, a little less than 300 feet, about 20 knots. The basic river class don't even have a helicopter deck. They've upgraded them to helicopter the fourth ship of the class to have a helicopter deck. Virtually all the Coast Guard cutters, the larger ones, are helicopter equipped.
There's a great example of that when we were talking about OPVs is, for example, the Nigerians, they're having that problem with piracy and controlling the seas off their shores, and that's the big thrust of their new naval program. It's all OPVs, and they went from one ship that had maybe partial helicopter capability, and they've increased that by 300 to 400%. I think they're adding 3 to 4 ships. They just got one of our old Coast Guard cutters. So like that for it seems like a lot of countries is a big thing. It's that flight deck, that ability to deploy helicopters, because that gives them even more range.
Yeah. Well, it's one thing if you're a country like Britain, where it's relatively compact, and they have land-based air, although Britain seems to have gotten rid of most of their MPA capability, but they're looking for another one. The Coast Guard itself has quite a few very long-range maritime patrol aircraft that coordinate with the cutters, but it's still good to have the helicopter because you'll be encountering boats that can run faster than your ship. So the only way to stop them is to use a helicopter. After much resistance, the Coast Guard finally went and armed their helicopters. Not heavily armed, no missiles, that sort of thing, but they have a 7.62-millimeter machine gun for firing warning shots, and they usually carry a 50-caliber sniper rifle for disabling outboard motors and that sort of thing. So that gives you the option of stopping a vessel that's, you know, a small vessel that's faster than you are, and that's the case with a lot of the smugglers.
Now, were you around the discussion back, was it the 1960s or the 1970s? I'm not sure when this debate happened, but the Pegasus-class missile boat. So folks look at the Cyclone class as kind of the only American style Corvette, and kind of just a side note off what you were saying is it's interesting you mentioned the caliber of weapons, because if you go to a place like, let's say, the Gulf of Arabia, pretty much all the navies are Corvettes, and they've all got large caliber guns and harpoon missile systems on them. So it's different, you know, different purposes and different layers. And the Baltic seems to have a lot of Corvettes that have at least 76s. But the United States, at two different points, there's the Cyclone-class patrol craft, but before that, Admiral Zumwalt's high-low concept, and he brought in the Pegasus missile boats. Were you around that, or did you have any thoughts on these really interesting – these were hydrofoils, and I think we only built, what, was it 5-6 of them? So it was – it seemed like a dead end when they planned to build, I think, what was it, 50? They planned to build a lot of them, and then they just stopped.
Well, I think a lot of the thought at the time was that they would use them to trail the Russian surface vessels, mark them for us. You know, they provide some persistence, and nobody could run away from them. And plus, of course, they would have some anti-ship capability if the balloon went up. About the same time, they were doing surface effects vessels. Both of those types...
Now, what's a surface effects vessel? I've never heard that term before, and that's obviously because I need to read more.
Talking about the air cushion vehicles.
Is this talking about market time? I believe part of the operations down in the southern swamps were done by air cushion vehicles. Is this a further extension of that project?
Well, market time was offshore. Game Warden was.
I'm sorry, Game Warden. Yes, I apologize.
Game Warden was in the rivers and swamps and that area there. And the Navy had quite a few swift boats, about 50 foot, armed with twin 50s in the front and a single 50 in the back with a over and under. It had an 81-millimeter mortar and a 50 caliber on top of that.
I saw pictures. First time I read Brownwater Black Berets and I saw that weapon, I was like, this is awesome.
It was invented by a Coast Guard gunner's mate.
Really? Well, I'm not surprised it was invented by a gunner's mate, because leave it to a gunner's mate to take two massive guns and weld them together.
The 82-footers did engage some steel-hull trawlers, you know, around 100, 120 feet long, that were armed with machine guns and recoilless rifles and that sort of thing. And the 81-millimeter mortar came in handy doing that. So.
I can imagine, yeah.
Surprisingly, we never had any trouble sinking the steel hull trawlers with the weapons that they had, 50 caliber machine guns and 81-millimeter mortars. It may have been because they were carrying so much ammunition that there were secondary explosions, because usually making holes in the hull above the waterline doesn't help much. Those Coast Guard cutters that were involved in market time, most of them had some ASW equipment, at least at one time. As they got older, the equipment became obsolete and they were removed, and the money saved on manning and maintenance and that sort of thing. But that's one thing about ships of that size. You can build a new one and equip it for the threat, the current threat, and then run it that way for 10, 15 years, and then as its equipment becomes obsolete, you can remove it, and the ship's still valuable for its constabulatory mission. I hate to say it, but that may be why the Coast Guard cutters that are out there right now are all about 40 years old. They still work for the constabulatory mission.
And you don't need any high-speed, low-drag equipment for a lot of law enforcement missions, since, as I can imagine, for the Coast Guard, a lot of their intel work is done on shoreside when it comes to trying to interdict smugglers. It's all trying to watch AIS and registered vessels and where they're going, and once it gets to the ship that's there at sea, since they're not going up against, you know, combatants who are trying to hide or folks with harpoon missiles, is a lot of what they need is, like, for example, like modern day PCs or the laptop I'm doing this podcast on, and you can put a new computer in a ship if it's new visualization material, or if you're going to chat with somebody, it's a lot different to install a new version, like all the ships that had Aegis installed in them for the first time. That's a huge project, or even modernizing that, whereas for a lot of what the Coast Guard does, not so much is required for that.
We have some ships now, 210-foot cutters. They're very simple. They were designed in the early 60s to be basically a offshore patrol vessel, but they also were given some weight and space reservation to allow them to carry torpedo tubes and a sonar, so that they would have been essentially subchasers. You know, the subchasers of World War II were like 300 tons, but this would have fill the same niche in the organization at 1,000 tons. Well, they're still around. They've still got a flight deck. They're actually pretty easy to maintain, although now that they're over 40 years old, some of the equipment's getting hard to find replacement parts. Because it is so simple, it's actually more reliable than the cutters that are about 10 years younger, that are more complex. One of the things you see with the Brits, they have kept their OPVs, their offshore patrol vessels, so simple that they can get many, many days a year underway out of them by rotating a crew through, and the crew is very small. So they're getting about 250 days a year underway.
Wow, wow. How old are these?
These are relatively new. These were made in 2004, 2005, something like that, the river class.
250 days a year and still going, that's really impressive for usage.
Yeah, well, you know, but then they don't have to go through sea squat, and they don't have long ref trays, and they don't have exercises to go through. So they're very mission-focused. They're doing fisheries patrols every day, you know.
Yeah, that's true. Or running into Russian warships off the coast of Scotland.
Yeah, that was an interesting episode, that they felt like they needed to run a Type 45 destroyer 600 miles up to check on the Russian there. Well, my feeling is if they had a Corvette, they could have watched them equally well. The Type 45 is not really made to take out a Russian cruiser because it's not currently.
No, it's mostly for air defense,
anti-surface.
Right?
Yeah, you know, they don't. They're talking about putting Harpoon on four of the six, but I don't think they've done that yet. And they're taking the Harpoon off of Type 23 frigates to put on the Type 45 destroyers. And they also don't have a CIWS on them yet, I don't believe. Although they've got weight and space reservation for them.
You know, that's something for folks that maybe aren't deep in the weeds is that's important, is when you talk about space and weight reservations, especially when I was on a PC, is everything's about weight. You have all,
right.
Like, especially folks come up with great ideas like, why don't we put this system on there and that system and this system? You'd be surprised at a certain point, weight does really become an issue, is how much weight of fuel do I have? How much weight of ammunition? If I put a really heavy weapon system now, I have less weight for this ammunition. Now, on Corvettes, on a bigger ship like a destroyer, you have a lot more room to play with. But when you come down to these Corvettes, now, once you're talking, well, I'm going to put a missile, I'm going to put a gun, I'm going to put a chaff system, and I'm going to have an integrated skiff for intel, you've just spent all the weight, and now you have no weight for food or berthing. So, depending on the size. So a lot of times these calculations, size has its advantages, but size really does have its disadvantages, and sometimes you can come up with these projects and they sort of fall apart. I want to move sort of slide to the side. We're talking a lot about OPVs and Corvettes in the sense of law enforcement, but let's take a step back and talk of them more in their conventional wartime mission, because a lot of folks, when they talk about these the sea fighter concept, they're really looking for a ship to fight in man-to-man combat. And Bob Work was on the November 24th episode of Midrats, and he said a big issue with these two is forward basing and logistics. And then Sven Ortman had his article on air defense and logistics as well. And so you have this little ship that you're putting out in harm's way for the purpose of creating that defense in depth and harassing the enemy and collecting intelligence. And you don't, like we talked about space and weight, I can't put a C-Wiz on a Cyclone class PC. It would be absolutely insane. And I don't want to do the maintenance anyways. That'd be absolutely horrible. So what are your thoughts on these issues of logistics and on air defense and how corvettes can kind of integrate into that problem set with those kinds of weaknesses?
Okay. Well, how you stand on this in a lot of ways depends on what you think a corvette is.
That's a fair point. It does get back to the beginning where we define what it is we're talking about.
Now, in a lot of the anti-surface talk, see a corvette as only something like a Swedish Visby, which is about 700 tons or so, real small, you know, real short range, really, very short range, almost, you know, successor to the PT boat of World War II. But on the other hand, a corvette could have a lot of range. And I see corvettes not so much in the ship-to-ship combat role as, because that's symmetrical, and I don't see us doing that. You know, I see our anti-ship systems as submarines and airplanes. But we need ships to do some things that airplanes and submarines can't do. The only, you know, when you look back at the old definition of cruisers, they did commerce protection, they did commerce raiding, they did scouting, they did anti-scouting to destroy the guys that were trying to get the information. Well, you know, now we have satellites and airplanes and submarines, and they do scouting and anti-scouting and screening and commerce rating and commerce protection and all those things. But there are just a couple of things that airplanes and submarines cannot do. That is, they can board vessels to determine the nature of their cargoes and that sort of thing. I'm talking about merchant vessels now.
Well, the Germans did that for a little bit, but then the commercial guys started putting deck guns on and everything, and then that sign kind of went south.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the submarines submarines tried to do that for a while.
Hey, probably. And you know what? Come to think of it, you probably don't want to do that with a nuclear submarine either. That's a little That's a little bit too much investment to roll up to a guy that could be covered in either, you know, deck guns or explosives.
Yeah. Well, also, during World War II, the submarines did a lot of interdiction of small coastal traffic, as well as sinking big warships and big merchant ships. Toward the end of the war, the fleet submarines were putting on 2 5-inch guns and destroying junks and coastal traffic. And if you look at some of the stuff that was happening in the Mediterranean, the British submarines were doing the same thing. But, you know, no SSN is going to do that.
It's just one of those colossally... It's like one of those ideas that's so bad, but you're like, oh, man, there's so many cool things I could do with this, but it's a terrible idea, but it would be so cool.
That's a place we might look at using air-independent, conventionally powered submarines, you know, to get at some of that stuff.
That's true, and the Zumwalt has that integrated electric drive, too. So the possibilities for future development are kind of interesting, but yeah.
Yeah, well, even the... AKEs have an integrated electric drive. And I think, I'm hoping that the new class of Coast Guard cutter will have an integrated system, or at least an electric cruise system to provide its redundant propulsion. You know, you could put all the diesel, put two diesels in the engine room, and then have a separate motor room running off of a separate generators to provide propulsion redundancy. You know,
yeah, that would make
so
sense.
So that if the engine room gets damaged, you still can make way.
Right. Absolutely. Maybe talk to, since we're talking to about electric drives and sort of power and fuel, and that gets us back onto fuel. Maybe talk a little bit about that logistics aspect. So we're talking about combat systems. We've talked about their combat capability. Let's talk a little bit to that logistics, the necessity for forward basing. Forward basing, is that really necessary? Captain Rubel on Midrats talked a little bit about the flotilla concept, and some people have suggested a float forward staging bases. So, and I'm sure you're very familiar with that, having, I'm sure, seen that in Vietnam with the LSTs. Now, here it would probably be a little less dramatic, but maybe some of your thoughts on the logistic aspect to corvettes.
Okay, well, being Coast Guard, we have to go without any logistic support or with very limited logistic support for long periods of time. So our ships tend to be long range. Our little 210-foot cutter has a range of about 7,000-8,000 miles, something like that. The new big cutter has segregated ballast, so you don't even need to contaminate the fuel tanks to do this when you can go over 12,000 miles.
Wow. That's just for people's reference, LCS is advertised as about 3,500 miles. So we're talking 12,000. That's an incredible distance.
The Freedom, the original Freedom is 3,500, I think. I think the later versions have got a bit more, but it still means that their diesel cruising speed is very limited, whereas, you know, it doesn't have to be that way. You don't necessarily have to go up on turbines to go 20 knots. There are lots of diesel-powered ships out there that can do 28 up to 30 knots.
33 if you're Cyclone class, but hey, that's into the wind, so just saying for everybody's information.
Yeah, you know, but that's a extremely high power-to-weight ratio. Our national security cutter, which is sometimes advertised as a potential platform for a frigate, they've got one LM2500 gas turbine and two diesels. The diesels alone...
Just for everybody's listening's reference, the gas turbine engine, we're basically talking something like an F4's engine inside of a ship, and then a diesel... Well, that's a diesel engine. So when you hear gas turbine engine, that's what we're talking about. We're essentially talking about a big jet engine.
You know, they're fairly common now. The new big deck amphibs are gas turbine powered. The FFGs were gas turbine powered. The Burks are gas turbine powered. Mixing diesels and gas turbines allows you to get the best of both. You know, you get long range and high speed. And they can all be geared together to drive both shafts. Our national security cutter, and it'll do 28 knots for a long time. I understand on trials it actually made 32, but 50,000 horsepower is about what a World War II destroyer were about. And they were going 35 consistently, so it's a lot of power. And if you put it in a small ship, today's corvettes, you know, we have tripled the size of every class of ship. Destroyers now are pushing 10,000 tons, which was a heavy cruiser during World War II.
Yeah.
Frigates, lots of new construction frigates out there now that are 6,000 or 7,000 tons.
They look like, and a lot of them just look like destroyers, too.
Yeah, well, the only thing that tells you they're not destroyers is that they don't go over 30 knots. But then, if you allowed a similar expansion of the definition, tripling the size of a World War II corvette, you'd be talking about a 4,500-ton ship, which is, you know, FFG size.
And that kind of gets back to folks that talk about defense often talk about asymmetry, and we talk about the A2AD threat. And you put enough money and you put enough people and resources into a single ship, land forces have this ability where they can disperse. You know, incoming shells, artillery fire, they can disperse. A ship, the crew can't disperse. You can't move the weapon systems around to avoid incoming enemy fire. So you put enough stuff on one big, expensive ship, and if your enemy can take it out, that gives him an incredible advantage. So in a lot of these cases, what we talk about when we say corvettes is we are talking about these smaller ships, is we want to disaggregate some of that value, some of that combat power out into little things that can escape from these new A2AD or irregular capabilities. You don't want a bunch of small boats that cost, you know, maybe $1 million a piece taking out a $1 billion warship. That's an insane return on investment for the enemy that you just don't want him to have, including the loss of life, because you put all those people onto one boat. If that boat gets taken out, all those people are out of the fight all at once.
The other aspect of this is the soft kill capability. Now, I saw something recently. They were talking about 150 or so cruise missile attacks, or 150. Of those, there was one hard kill. That was a cruise missile fired at the Missouri, and it was taken out by a British destroyer, I believe. All the other misses were due to soft kills. And if you make your target a lot smaller, I mean, it's a lot easier for a corvette to hide than an aircraft carrier.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And to hide in the chaff cloud, too, you know. So it's easier to facilitate the soft kill if you have a small ship than a huge one.
That's a good point. Cyclone class PCs used to have chaff, and you know, bigger ships, it is more of a long shot with chaff. And
but in fact, you know, you can only put up so much too, no matter how big you are.
and even too, folks maybe don't realize this is, and the Brits had a problem with this, I think, during the Falklands War. That's how their
Atlantic conveyor.
The Atlantic conveyor, I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, got hit because another ship put up chaff. That chaff functioned. It avoided the ship that Exocet was aimed at. Unfortunately, that chaff took it right into the Atlantic conveyor. So,
it destroyed all of their heavy lift helicopters except one.
which became one of the most overworked helicopters in the fleet.
Yeah. So, it was a great advertisement for Boeing.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. You wanted to talk about what you thought would be the, I like your terminology you discussed with me, the well-dressed corvette of the 21st century. So I don't know if you're trying to make the corvettes sound like a beautiful woman, or if we're trying to make a reference to cars, but either way, I like the sort of the lyrical nature of that.
Okay. Well, one thing I did talk about was the fact that if you're the United States, you know, and you have a lot of other warships to carry the load in the first few months of a major conflict, maybe you don't want to load up your corvette with weapon systems initially. You may want to build a ship with limited capabilities, but wait in space reservation for upgrades later. But if you're somebody like those Gulf nations for whom their corvette is their flagship, they're probably going to want to give it a complete outfit. And to do that, I sort of broke it up into different mission areas. Okay, if you're only looking for constabulary stuff, you can get by with a gun and a boat and a helicopter. But once you start looking at ASW, you probably want to have that helicopter fitted for ASW, have magazines for torpedoes and sonobuoys and that sort of thing on your Corvette. But you also probably want a CAPTAS, an active or passive towed array. And from what I hear, the LCSs are getting a CAPTAS 4, which is a French-British active and passive towed array. Supposed to be a really good system. The British love it. There is a junior version of that. The CAPTAS 4 is for the larger ships, but they also make CAPTAS 2 for lighter ships.
The second this project touches LCS, it'll stop working. That's kind of what I don't know. I don't know if it's LCS is maybe LCS is a good idea and it's just cursed. Just everything that touches it falls into dust. But hey, that's beside the point.
I actually think they did a couple of good things with LCS. I think the idea of having a reconfigurable space is a good idea. And so do a lot of other people. You know, the Danes are doing it, and the British are doing it on the Type 26, which is their next frigate coming out sometime, hopefully. And a reconfigurable space is a good idea, allowing you to change and add things and bring people on for different missions and that sort of thing. But it's not a good idea to do this too often. And the fact that they can't do it in 24 hours or whatever doesn't bother me much at all, because I think once they load it on, the ship's going to be there doing the same mission for quite a while.
Right. You think of it more as a I'm not running back home and grabbing a bunch of new equipment every few hours. You're thinking of this more as strategic or long-term operational threats change. You have the space to check. Okay, so that's a lot more humble desire and workable than I think what they started out with, which I think is unfortunate. Is once you taint something with expectations, you kind of carry that with you for a long time.
Yeah. Well, one thing about a small ship like a Corvette, they tend to be specialist, and if they specialize, they can get really good at it. We've had the USS England with the ASW specialist, six submarines. The British had Walker's ASW group that just sank an amazing number of U-boats because they were specialized in that. Even the Italians had a little 800-ton Corvette that sank three British submarines and assisted in sinking a fourth. So, you know, you get people focused on one mission, they can get really good at it. That's actually one of the advantages of these ships compared to a do-everything ship like a Burke.
And a lot of that, too, comes from procurement discipline.
There's actually two more points I wanted to make. 21st century Corvette. Okay, on AAW, Sven Ortmann really opened my eyes on that one and convinced me. I had actually already been convinced that gun systems as CIWS are a non-starter, because you can't engage. You know, if you get several missiles coming inbound at the same time,
you can't engage all of them.
The gun system cannot deal with that. You need missiles that are fire and forget, you know, and you just point one at every missile and let it go.
Right.
And there's several systems like that now.
Mm-hmm.
Micah, Ram, Barak from Israel. But the one I really like is called Sea Scepter. The British are making that, and the New Zealanders have just picked it up. It's not on a ship yet, but it has all sorts of great characteristics. So I would suggest looking up CAMM, C-A-M-M. All these missiles are derivatives of air-to-air missiles, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Even the South Africans make one called Umkhonto, I believe it is, in both IR and radar versions. But the neat thing about a lot of these is you don't need separate fire control channels to control them, so you can fire off as many missiles as you need.
Huh.
You know?
There's a lot of good. The Commonwealth has this weird tendency to produce. Like Nulka is awesome. It's a chaff system. It's a little big for a corvette, but that comes from Australia. So there's always seems to be these really interesting weapon systems coming out of the Commonwealth.
By the way, we have that on the National Security Cutter.
Oh, you have Nulka on the National Security Cutter.
Yep.
Wow. That's an interestingly high soft kill capability for a Coast Guard cutter. Where are you planning on sending those things?
Well, they have their wartime missions too.
That's true. You know, that's fair. That's fair.
The other thing is that I wanted to point out that the number of missiles being carried is probably going to increase. The missiles are probably going to get smaller. You know, the naval strike missile that the Norwegians
right.
are building, that's a little bit smaller than Harpoon. A lot of corvettes out there, Indian, Vietnamese, Russian, they're not carrying 8 missiles anymore. They're carrying 16.
And they're getting more irritating, like the BrahMos missile is a terrifying weapon, and all these other, like the Hubei. The Hubei is a great example. The Chinese built a Trimaran corvette with a bunch of Charlie 802s or Charlie 803s, I think they might be able to work with, that they have one mission. They drive out in a huge pile, pump a huge number of anti-ship cruise missiles into the air, and then just drive away. Of course, we're still rolling around with Harpoon, so I'm hoping there's something to old school being, you know, worth something, but every day that goes by, you're like, ooh, wow, that is a really, really cool missile, and I have Harpoon. Got it. Okay.
Or on your PC, you don't have Harpoon.
No, we have the modification of Javelin on the PCs now. So, I mean, that's okay, but I'd rather have Brimstone, but that's just me.
Yeah, I wanted to mention Brimstone. I think that's probably great little missile, you know, having data link back to the launcher.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, you could probably replace a 6-inch artillery shell with that and do naval gunfire support. Two missions that surface ships can do that no one else can do. One of them is the visit, search, boarding.
Visit, board, search, and seizure. Yeah, VBSS.
Yeah. The other one is that they can rescue the crews of our own merchant ships that are sunk. And if we don't have some provision for doing that, it's going to get really hard to get people to man merchant ships.
You're talking about in a conventional war environment where it's unrestricted
yeah.
warfare. Okay, absolutely.
The U.S. Navy does not have enough ships to escort convoys, economic convoys, certainly not even some of our higher priority cargoes. Our fleet train is running around totally unarmed, you know, and unprotected. And I think in wartime, we can't assume that they will be able to do that.
Right.
We can perhaps protect them with P-8s or P-3s, you know.
Against submarines, yeah.
But then if they're torpedoed and the guys are in the water,
it's nothing
2,000 miles from land, who's going to pick them up?
the other merchants floating around getting shot at with torpedoes, unfortunately, would be the only ones.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'll be nonplussed at that little mission that they've been given.
So, you know, I think there's a need for vessels that are capable of doing visit, boarding, search, seizure, and for doing rescue missions, including having a helicopter on to pick people up out of the water, take them off the sinking ship, that sort of thing, before the ship gets there. Okay, but once you have made those ships, then you can look at the marginal cost of adding ASW systems to them so that they can actually contribute to the protection as well.
One last thing here before we finish up, and we were planning to do a 30 minutes today and then follow it up with something from Federal News Radio that we did, but Chuck Hill is brilliant and fascinating, so here we are, almost to an hour, and I plan to bring you back because doing through this whole question, there's a whole bunch of other stuff that I want to talk about, but you mentioned in one of your final articles for Corvette Week, you started talking a little bit about Arctic corvettes, talking about ice breaking and the Coast Guard's desire for a new OPV. Maybe talk about a little bit about that, because that's going to be an increasingly important mission, sort of the value of OPVs in the Arctic and what corvettes can do, maybe that ships of the line can't, when it comes to areas that are really cold and iced over and those sorts of situations.
Okay. Well, you know, the Navy's mobile. They go where the trouble is, that sort of thing. Right now we don't see any kind of conflict coming out in the Arctic. There are disagreements about who owns which piece of territory, but everyone seems to be willing to take it to court and let a tribunal decide the results, but that may change. You know, operations up there are very important to the Russians. We've had pretty good relations with the Russians lately, seems like. Every year the Coast Guard does a exercise and conference with our counterparts in the Russian equivalent of the Coast Guard. Used to be the Maritime Border Troops of the KGB, but and they have some pretty good warships.
Slightly friendlier name nowadays.
Yeah. And, you know, they're painted blue and they've got stripes on the side. Russians are probably the biggest users of corvettes in the world. They've got a brand new one out now that's really quite nice. Plus they're building them in the Baltic and running them down a river to the Caspian Sea. They're sort of the capital ships of the Caspian Sea fleet. Now I'm really kind of excited about the new Coast Guard cutter that's coming out, because I think that in some ways it's a better warship than the National Security Cutter. It's smaller, but it's equipped essentially the same way, except it doesn't have a CIWS on board, but it has provision for one, I believe. It's got a Mark 110, 57 millimeter. It'll have a 25 millimeter stabilized gun and have a good aviation facilities. We're not sure how fast it's going to be. It's going to be somewhere between 22 and 25 knots, 7,500 mile range, and they'll be ice strengthened, which is kind of a unique characteristic. Not quite icebreakers, but it'll be safe to send them up into the Arctic, at least during the summertime, especially if there's an icebreaker around to break them out in case they get in trouble. I'm hoping that they'll have a reconfigurable space, too. I'm not sure that they will. If they have not cut the corners too tightly in terms of weight and space, the objective was to be able to take on board an MH-60. As I say, they're really having to look at the capabilities in detail because the Coast Guard budget has been being cut pretty severely. We have gone a long time without needing to build new ships, and now that we do, they're saying, but you never needed that money before.
Yeah, that is the unfortunate. But we always talk about that with the budget, and that's the whole problem is people think of it as, if I don't spend it, it'll never be there, and then people argue against that. But then a situation like that shows up where you say, well, look, there it is. I asked for the money. I didn't spend the money I didn't need, and here we are, and I need it, and no one's got it for me. So it's an unfortunate justification of a lot of the way that a lot of people approach the budget.
You know, the total Coast Guard shipbuilding budget this year that the Congress, that the administration presented, was less than $1 billion. And, you know, every Burke-class destroyer costs $2 billion. And we're trying to build an icebreaker, national security cutters, patrol boats that are very similar in size to your Cyclone class. We are building 4 to 6 of those a year and aiming at 58 of those. Basically, I don't consider anything under 500 tons a corvette, although there are some things like the Tarantle class Russian missile boats that I would consider a corvette.
Well, like you said at the beginning, it's really oftentimes that these naming conventions are either confusing or just often just arbitrary. Like we said, cruisers. What other than a tacit connection does the cruiser of today have to the cruiser of yesterday? Sure, they can both operate independently, but one is a behemoth, and the other one was actually just a hodgepodge of frigates and corvettes. So it really depends. It almost seems like it's which decade are you in?
Yeah. Well, you know, World War II destroyer, 2,500 tons. Today, 2,500 tons, pretty sure that's a corvette.
That's true. Chuck, at the end here, is there anything that you'd like to plug? You do have your blog that we often pull from because you have some great insights. That's the Chuck Hills Coast Guard blog. So it's really not that. It's pretty upfront. It tells you exactly what it is. That's Chuck Hill. scgblog.net. So the only difference between that people really need to know is that it is a .net. So Chuck Hill's CG blog, spell that out, put a .net at the end. And is there anything else that you have that you think folks should look into, or maybe a book that you'd recommend to read, or some other material you have out there? Other than the amazing, awesome SimSec, which is www.cimsec.org.
No, that's pretty much it. Actually, most of the authors that did stories for this also have blogs of their own, and some of them are very good.
Oh, now wait, now let's clarify. All of them are very good.
All of them are very good.
All of them are good. Now, I'm not going to say which one of my writers is not a good blog.
They're all worth a look.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the thing about the Corvette Week, we had all sides.
Yes, we had
people who were in favor of it. We had people who were against it.
And people on the fence.
We had all sorts of questions. It was not a hatchet job.
It was a fine product, Chuck, and really, as the editor of the blog, too, I got to thank you because that took a whole bunch of work off my plate. The blog just ran an auto for two solid weeks, and all I had to do with the podcast. So I can also credit you with giving me a little break. But no, that was fantastic work, and personally, my favorite week because of the amount of material and the amount of passion people put into it too. And just for people's awareness, we've got some other weeks coming up. There's an announcement on the blog today about the upcoming Maritime Satire Week. So let me know about that if you're interested in writing for that. We're going to have a Drone Tactics Week as soon as USNI publishes its big drones edition this year. We're going to have a private security contractor, private military contractor week. We're also going to have an air-sea battle week come February. It looks like we're going to have around 8 different writers on different sides of the fence to turn that into a little fur ball of arguments on that godforsaken topic. But it's a debate worth having. So there's a lot of great stuff coming up, a lot of really interesting material. And if you've got something that you'd like to talk about, hey, put it our way too, because we're all a forum. And if you have material, bring it to the table. And we're not inaccessible people. We're really interested in hearing what you have to say. Hey, Chuck, thanks so much for coming on the show today.
My pleasure.